Hello and welcome back to Podcasts from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. The election for the second time of Donald Trump as President of the United States has everyone talking, or talking, running scared, elated, defeated, and a lot of people quietly satisfied. Certainly there have been a lot of red faces among the US and wider liberal commentariat who'd confidently predicted that Trump would lose. I mean, who would elect a convicted felon, an obvious racist, a serial liar, an intellectual retard, and a narcissist to boot? Well, the American electorate did exactly that, and they, by and large, are very sober and sensible people who, like the rest of us, simply want to live better lives. Trump not only beat U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris, he beat her comprehensively. And while endless books will be written analyzing why, we're not going to do that here. Back in the day when I was a newspaper editor, I used to irritate my colleagues by insisting that all the stories they wrote had to answer just one question. The question was, so what? So what if whatever you were writing, however important you thought it was, the president had fallen under a bus or a building had collapsed, if you didn't make an effort to explain why you thought what you were writing was important, then we wouldn't print it or we'd send it back to you until you came up with a reasonable view of why you thought it was important. And if you couldn't do that, we'd make one up in your own name and print it that way. So there was a lot of pressure on people to answer the question, so what, and I want to try and do that here as well. I'm very grateful to do that, to answer the so what, to welcome former Democratic Alliance leader and Government of Nashville Unity architect, one of them, Tony Leon, back to the podcast. And Tony, I was very relieved to have said in a Sunday Times column a few weeks before November 5 that I thought Trump would win. I had a wobble near the end, but I thought Harris was generally a very, very poor candidate.
Peter, I agree with you, except, of course, you know, I suffer from that terrible malady called confirmation bias. So all I do is I screen out inconvenient data and find data that reinforces my own preferences. And so I did hope Harris would win, not because I thought she was anything other than a very ordinary, maybe mediocre candidate, but for all the reasons that you described about Donald Trump's unfitness for office, in my view. So, you know, putting my money where my fat mouth is, I took with a well-known local politician a bet that Harris would win. That cost me two bottles of Johnny Walker Black I've got to deliver on Friday evening. And interesting enough, there's a chap in our office who in other respects is very liberal, and but he's hugely anti-woke. And we had a 500 Rand bet that Trump would win or Harris would win, and I lost that too. So it's been last Tuesday was an extremely expensive day for the Leon household. But what it'll do for the world, as you said in your intro, is of much greater consequence.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. The so what? So if you were a newspaper reporter and I was your editor, and you said, you know, you were the foreign correspondent, and I was saying, right, we're going to lead with your story. Your first paragraph is Donald Trump yesterday won the American election. Now you have to write in your so what paragraph. You've got 25 words. I mean, what's the crisp so what to him winning?
Well, let's be parochial, as South Africans like to be often. It's a very big deal, and it's probably a very bad deal for South Africa. That would be my one-liner on this, and for reasons we can elaborate on, Pete.
Yeah. Yeah. So before we get there, we've all watched the sort of rise of, and this is, I found this interesting, and I only realized it after he'd won, that we've watched right-wing populist rise all around the world. We've watched it in France, we've watched it in Hungary, various parts of Europe. But the rise or the resurrection of Trump seemed to me to be all the more kind of present in our lives because it happened in English, not in French or, you know, a language that which you might battle to grasp.
It's Hungarian, on our screens. Yes, yes.
Exactly. Then social media. I wonder what it means generally for the world, you know. I mean, I remember the editor of the FT, Lionel Barber, 4 or 5 years ago, interviewed Vladimir Putin. And the lead story in the paper the next day was, Putin says the end of liberal democracy is nigh. And I wonder whether... Well, I wonder what you think the Trump victory means for liberal democracy and its sort of softer edges, you know, choose your pronoun, choose your gender. This all seems very much a reaction to that?
Oh, look, I think Trump's victory very much was a declaration of defeat for the woke world in America, maybe in the wider world as well. And maybe in that respect, it's not a terrible thing. But where I actually don't, I think Trump is a very norm-busting politician and phenomenon. I also don't actually think he's not in any sense a classical right-wing politician. He certainly is a populist and a nationalist and a nativist. So, for example, a lot of his economic proposals, which are going to do, you know, I think huge damage to South Africa, but we can discuss that, really could have been suggested by Bernie Sanders on the far left of the Democratic Party, you know, putting up tariffs, protecting American industries and workers. And if you go back in time to the 1930s or late 1920s, say a century ago, that America had started a trade war with, I think it was called the Smoot-Hawley Act of Congress. I mean, that was very modest in the sense it was only 6% tariffs. I mean, Trump is now proposing 10% minimum tariffs on any country that has a trade surplus with the United States. And in the case of China, 60%. So, and Mexico sort of unlimited because he's going to use tariffs, or he says he will, as a means of enforcing immigration limits from Mexico and Central America. So, I mean, this is not a classic right-wing thing. I mean, you know, you can look at the ANC manifesto here, or for what it's worth, the EFF-MK. You'll find a lot of that economic populism of Trump, you know, right, sitting very comfortably in the middle of the ANC-EFF-MK spectrum. So I think that's one thing. But you know, as someone much cleverer than me said, Peter, America wants a strong man. And there's a, you know, a lot of data suggesting, and we see it actually in South Africa as well, that, well, given a choice between having an effective leader who busted norms of democracy and decency and someone who could deliver the goods, as opposed to one who, a bit Biden-esque, like, you know, stayed within the lanes of constitutional democracy, a hefty number of people would choose the former over the latter. And so I think that's what we're looking at, in addition to obviously the fact that Trump mined a deep vein of resentment among a whole group of people who would be, I suppose, arguably conservative or right-wing. But I think there's more to it than just that.
It's interesting, you know, and I hadn't thought of this until you were talking just now, but the power of American power has rested almost, certainly the power of the dollar has rested on America running trade deficits. In other words, the world has been allowed to export to America and get paid in dollars, right? And it's one of the reasons, I think, why the dollar is the currency that it is today. Because it's simply because America has sort of done its duty by the world. Everybody trades with it. Everybody sells into America. And it's interesting that he would reverse that at a moment when the dollar is under particular attack. If you no longer need to pay, if you're no longer being paid in dollars because your imports are now to the U.S. are being restricted, you change the calculation in a way, I think. I mean, I'm no economist, but it does strike me, and I've seen this argued a number of times, that it was America after the war opened its markets to the rest of the world, and that's one of the reasons that the dollar is as strong today, because everybody got paid in dollars.
Absolutely, Peter. But look, there's another sort of irony in all this. I mean, if Trump actually goes ahead with his trade policies, and you know, he probably will to some or greater extent, it will also do something else, which, of course, you wrote about both before and after Trump's election. That is, this election was won, in his case, and lost, in Harris's case, or Biden's case, on inflation, because inflation has been an unhappy phenomenon of the post-COVID world in America, when its economy and stimulus packages and so on. But of course, you know, if Trump restricts the flow of cheap exports to America and protects through autarky local, arguably uncompetitive industries in the Rust Belt, for example, where he won all those swing states, then it's actually going to be inflationary. So at the kind of the calling card of the Trump victory, which was deep dissatisfaction with rising prices, could just come back through another route of him introducing a set of policies, which I think any economist, and as you and I are not economists, would say is going to have a net inflationary impact. So it is somewhat ironic, but you know, it's early days. We simply don't know. And of course, the other feature about Trump is he's completely unpredictable. He's both transactional, so it depends what's in it for him or you know, America. Yeah. And you don't actually know because, in his case, the past does not prologue to the present or even to the future.
Yeah. No, it is amazing. I mean, let's talk about America's place in the world. I mean, whatever it is part of, it's in charge of. You know, if it's not the UN or climate negotiations or just about anything, finance, trade, culture, it's... So what does the world look like where America just isn't interested anymore or not doesn't want to take part? I mean, there will be things it wants to take part in. It's got the biggest military in the world, so you've got to listen. But there'll be a whole lot of things like climate, I suppose, where it's just simply going to withdraw and say, oh, you're all talking rubbish, and we're going to build more coal-fired power stations or whatever.
Well, it's one thing that might be good for us for our export profile as America, reinvigorates the coal industries. But apart from that, it's pretty bleak. Of course, you're right. I mean, America is just huge. And, I don't want to be one of these also-rans, but I am absolutely a skeptic when people say America's power is declining. Of course, it's not what it was 20 or 30 years ago. But it's still, on so many measurements, is the number one country in the world. You mentioned the military, economically. I mean, America... in the last 4 years, the Biden administration has economically surged and China has stalled. So China, I recall reading, a lot of confident predictions 15 years ago, round about last year was going to overtake America as the number one economy in the world. Well, it hasn't and might never do so or won't do so for a long time. And then, of course, but the real thing, because, as you know, and a lot of listeners do, it's not kind of, your bulk, but it's your nimbleness. And I mean, still in terms of R&D, technology, science, we mentioned, America patents issued, registered, is just, just overwhelms every other country by a country mile. So that is why America does matter. But if there's a retrenchment of and by America from the world, I think, it's going to be very significant. And the obvious place, which is far away from us, is on the eastern frontier of Europe. I mean, Ukraine, for example. If, in fact, Trump goes ahead and pulls the military and financial aid for Ukraine, well, I don't know that Europe, which has got a lot of problems, is going to step in and fill the breach. And then you've got to say, well, what's the future of Ukraine? And then what happens in Poland? What happens in the Baltic states? I mean, these are very serious consequences. I mean, South Africa has economic and political consequences flowing from Trump version 2, but they are less than those countries literally
definitely.
On the front line.
No, when you and the same would apply presumably in the Middle East, where Trump is no longer going to sort of sit on the fence between Israel and the Palestinians or Israel's Arab neighbors. He's going to climb in on the side of Israel. And so one of the good things that came out of the Trump, the first Trump administration in Israel was what they call the Abraham Accords, where the Trump administration had managed to persuade Gulf countries and countries like Egypt to consider restoring relations with Israel, and it was a real prospect for a while. That's going to die too. So that's going to be it's going to be hostile territory for America, I presume, and for basically most of the West for a long time to come.
Yeah, look, I mean, if you're the Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, you're quite delighted, because not only is Trump sort of pro-Israel, but he's kind of pro-Likud. It's, he's got a view on Israel and how it should project its strength that actually is probably goes way beyond what many Israelis, including my Israeli wife, think would be wise or appropriate. So I think Netanyahu, who's another strongman leader of the type you described earlier, is going to be emboldened by this. And of course, just to come back to us for a moment, I cannot but think that a lot of the steps South Africa did and has undertaken the last few months and year or so
in terms of that conflict will boomerang against South Africa's national and international interest because of Trump and the people who he's putting into his foreign policy team. I don't know if you saw, the first foreign policy pick he made was Elise Stefanik, who's a hardline congresswoman from United, from New York, who's now just been named.
To go to the UN.
Go to the UN. And we, when South Africa launches prosecution in the ICJ of Israel over Gaza, she said, this is anti-Semitic and it's shameful. And then you have Marco Rubio, who today was named as Secretary of State designate, who lambasted South Africa, I think, just 2 weeks ago for its stance on Taiwan and elbowing the Taiwanese trade office out of Pretoria and ejecting them to Joburg. He said, you know, you're succumbing to Chinese bullying diplomacy. So, I mean, if you look at the lineup there versus the positions we've taken here, you've got to say there's a misalignment. And there's, of course, it could very well be the ANC doesn't care. I mean, they're just going to carry on as before and, you know, to hell with the consequences. But there will be consequences. I think we can, you know, be adult about it.
So into this mess, we apparently are about to reappoint Ebrahim Rasool as ambassador to Washington. Listen, to be fair, we haven't had decent diplomatic representation in Washington for a couple of years. We've had an acting ambassador for a year, and the ambassador before him was ill. So this is not his first tour there. I don't know him at all, but I'd be interested to know knowing what we know the American attitude may begin to South Africa, how much it might change. I'd be interested to know what you think Ebrahim Rasool might have to do to cope, to soften, or to defend us.
Well, that's a very interesting question. Obviously, you know, I've no doubt exercising Mr. Rasool's mind. Well, let's start with the pluses. He's been there before, so he knows his way around the capital, and you know, he's a live presence.
Yeah.
I mean, he's articulate and personal.
Yeah.
So that's a plus, and it's an improvement on the kind of ground zero of the South African embassy before. The minuses are also quite considerable in his case, and in anyone's said there. Number one, I mean, he's an ANC partisan politician. I'm not sure that's going to cut too much ice with a conservative Trumpian majority in the Senate, like in the House and certainly in the White House. Secondly, just to get any attention in Washington now for a country as marginal to the MAGA interests as South Africa, we really are marginal, is going to be hard. I mean, investors can make a difference. We saw recently the obituaries to someone like Robin Renick, who was a very effective ambassador. Jorge Hani came from a much smaller country, Chile. Just when Mandela was president, he cut a swathe, he and his wife, through Johannesburg and had quite a bit of clout here. So the personality of an ambassador can help. I think the problem Rasool has is threefold. Number one, he's on record with some pretty harsh anti-Trump statements. They might all have been valid when he delivered them at the Cape Town Press Club in December 2020. But, you know, the Trump world, you know, keeps lists and nurtures resentment. So that probably won't get him off to a flying start. Number two, he can only build on what he's got. And the South African diplomatic presence, feeble as it's been, has largely been to concentrate on one corner of Capitol Hill, and that's the Black Congressional Caucus, which actually under Biden, because Biden was hugely dependent on people like Jim Clyburn and the Black vote, it made, and even if it wasn't designed that way, it was quite helpful. Well, it's going to count, you know, for absolutely nothing now. You're much better off if you've got the ear of the evangelicals or the moral majority or whoever it is. I mean, the Black Congressional Caucus is going to have no sway or clout with the Trumpists. And so that's the second thing. But then, look, those are arguably things that you can overcome. The real problem is, for him or anyone else, if the Archangel Gabriel descended from the heavens as our man or person in Washington, they would confront this, that South Africa is misaligned as far as the future U.S. administration is concerned. It's pro-Iran. It's a big investor and friend of Iran, brought Iran into BRICS. Iran is enemy number one of the United States. I mean, the Iranians are implicating in a plot to kill Trump before the election. Then you've got China. Now, China, of course, is huge in the world. We are a prop of China trade. And one of the stated aims of Trump is to actually, you know, bring China to heel economically. So we are kind of on the other side of that play. And then thirdly, of course, you've got Israel, which, you know, is South Africa, for reasons that I really don't understand, since we are hardly in a position, has really promoted the top of its international relations agenda with little effect, except to seriously alienate the incoming administration in Washington. And, you know, so those are really three big strikes. And then, of course, you know, we've got the objective situation, never mind what we do from time to time, and that is we have a trade surplus with the United States, although it's, you know, it's an accounting error compared to China. You know, someone in the department in the U.S. Trade Representative is going to run an algorithm and say, which countries have got trading deficit, which got a surplus? We're going after all countries that have a surplus with us. That's going to be the starting point. Of course, you can argue your way out of that. So that sort of agenda, in my view, I might be quite wrong. Maybe Mr. Rasool, you should get him on your program. He can tell you his view on it. But, you know, those are the objective hurdles that he's going to confront when he touches down in Washington, D.C., I think.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I mean, the other side of Trump, because he is erratic and, as you said, unpredictable, he's going to spend perhaps 2 hours in this entire administration talking about Africa. You know, if there were, it's just possible, because we've this part of the world has always done fairly well out of conservative leaders out there. You know, Margaret Thatcher did pretty well with Zimbabwe. I mean, Margaret Thatcher liberated Zimbabwe in many respects. The Labour Party that she replaced didn't know what it was doing. When AIDS took hold of South Africa, it was George Bush who started the PEPFAR program. I don't know how many hundreds of billions of dollars have flowed into AIDS relief programs and into South Africa. I understand that Israel is a particular, really particular problem now for South Africa, given that it's Trump that they're going to have to be dealing with. But, you know, are there sort of extenuating circumstances where somebody like Cyril Ramaphosa might be able to build some kind of rapport with him? Let's say it was through South African connections. I mean, do you know that the only person Donald Trump follows on Twitter who isn't an American is Gary Player?
And Ernie Els, I think.
I'm telling you.
Or the other way around. But one or both of them, yes.
I'm not sure. If you look at Donald Trump's Twitter feed, you can check who he follows. There are only about 100 people. One of them is Gary Player. And he's the only foreigner.
Yeah.
Just more generally, you know, and then you've got obviously the Elon Musks of the world, who Cyril had a meeting with, and does Elon stick his oar into a conversation and say, well, you know, let's go and have a look, or let's give him a break, or whatever it might be. It's interesting, you know, and Trump is vulnerable to flattery, I'm sure.
He's a great flatterer. He's a great schmoozer, Cyril. It's his core strength.
Yeah.
And he uses it very effectively. So maybe, look, Trump has a very famous short attention span. I've never met Donald Trump. I know what I read, and I don't always read the right things. Proves my election forecasting inabilities. But, I think you're right. I think a lot of it's personal, a lot of it's transactional. And maybe Gary Player or Ernie Els could be a better trade emissary than the usual schleppers that we use for such purposes.
You know, 18 holes of golf at Mar-a-Lago with Gary Player. What does that buy you?
It probably buys you a lot of goodwill.
Yeah, but you're not allowed to win.
That's right. And apparently, I won't say whether he's honest when he plays golf. But anyway, yeah, he's quite a good golfer, Trump. Let's be fair. But Cyril's not a good golfer, but he plays golf, so maybe he can get a few holes in with Donald, and that'll set the relationship. But you know, at the end of the day, you've got to deliver,
I mean, you can have good vibes, and those are very important. I don't, you know, I've been a politician for many years, and I was a diplomat for a few years, and I do not at all discount the importance of personal relations with Trump. Personal relationships are hugely important, and if you can build it, that's fantastic. It's certainly, you know, there is absolutely, there's no downside to it, but you've got to get the attention. And, you know, you mentioned Musk, who's hugely influential. I mean, sort of number in the top five in the new Trump world. You know, South Africa needs to stop dithering about on Starlink. I mean, if they don't make it easy for Musk to bring Starlink here, not that Musk needs it, but it's a symbolic thing, then yeah. I think we're going to have a negative impact on Trump world via Elon Musk.
Well, in the absence of a good relationship with Trusk, with Trump, do we have, what are our alternatives? Do we build our own defenses? And I mean, build other alliances? Do we, or, you know, we can't carry on appealing at every foreign forum we address for fairness in the world and justice and, you know, which seem to be our central appeals to the big powers. The Americans aren't going to listen to appeals for a UN Security Council seat, or let alone a veto. I mean, the veto is going nowhere, BRICS or no BRICS. You know, it's just not going to happen. It's not going to come from China or Russia or the Americans. But we continue just to beat the same really boring drum out there. It's almost as if we're sort of begging. It's kind of weird. I mean, what do we do outside the US that's going to be useful? Do we just go full on for BRICS and take sides? But even in BRICS, there's a question about whether there should be a block, you know, a power block. The Indians aren't happy with it. The Brazilians are neither. And I mean, the Chinese and Russians might want it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the problem with BRICS, you've got Russia in it, you've got China in it, you've got Iran in it. So the more you cozy up there, the probably more you alienate America. But the question is, what's its capacity to really be effective as an international economic or diplomatic lever? That's open to question. You know, you look at a country, well, Brazil, I mean, which is never fails to not reach its potential. Brazil, at least diplomatically, is very adept. It's smart. It's nimble. India is even smarter and more nimble. So India looks after its own interests and uses its diplomatic outreach to advance those. South Africa's, you know, I was talking to a very major journalist here from a, you know, international periodical magazine. We're talking about South Africa's foreign policy, and he said, you know, it's rather junior common room stuff. It's like, you know, undergraduate stuff. It's impulse driven. It's not driven saying, well, our objective is to increase the GDP growth of South Africa to 4%, to get unemployment down from 32% to 25%, and therefore I'm actually going to, those are the ends. All my means, including my international projection, my domestic policies are towards those two ends. And if you do that, which is the kind of the Indian approach, you get a different foreign policy profile. It doesn't mean, incidentally, that South Africa has to kowtow to every demand of America or, you know, the Make America the Marker agenda. I'm not suggesting that for a moment. You've got to have self-respect to this. But you've also got to be smart about it. You can't just, you know, keep, you know, relitigating the wars of the 1970s and 80s, which really does seem to what our foreign policies amount to. You know, Russia was good to us. Soviet Union was nice. Well, you know, so what? That was in, you know, 1979. We're now in 2024. Doesn't matter.
I think it was on YouTube, but there was a Ronald Lamola, the foreign minister, or Durko minister, his opening remarks at a sit-down meeting with Antony Blinken last month, or possibly in September. I was interested in how keen he was to stress that we just had an open and free election, and that the ANC had lost its majority, and that instead of behaving badly, it had formed this coalition, the GNU, with some of its ideological opponents. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, that's really good stuff for to soften up a liberal like the U.S. Secretary of State. But Trump wouldn't give a hoot for how well you'd behaved in an election or who you had formed a coalition with. I mean, he would have argued for, you know, why didn't you question the results? Or, I mean, I just wonder, you know, I'm making
he would have called you a loser.
He doesn't like losers.
Yes.
Yeah, just one thing we haven't mentioned, mainly because, it, you know, everything's personal with a lot of people and politics, not everything, but sometimes. Yeah. You know, you take the new Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who views kind of domestic and foreign calling card is a hatred for the Castro and successor regimes in Cuba. I mean, he is the child of Cuban immigrants who fled from Castro. So I imagine early in that future conversation, he's going to grill South Africa, what's your stance on Cuba? Which, of course, you know, we are close friends. And none of the positions that South Africa takes are indefensible. They aren't. Well, some of them are, but some of them aren't, and the explanations. But once again, you go back to the core question, what is it costing you? Because if your policies land up costing you far more than they're benefiting you, they've got to be reconsidered. But that actually requires a degree of maturity, and there might be maturity in parts of the South African government. It seems to have bypassed the DIRCO, the International Relations Department, almost entirely, because they are really banging drums that, you know, went out of fashion, as I said, in about 1989 or 79.
Is Ronald Lamola an improvement on the previous foreign minister? I think he is, by the way. So
I think he's much less poisonous. I think she was, in many ways, Lady Pandor, a pot of poison. I use that advisedly. I think, you know, her utterances of the 7th of October last year were absolutely poisonous. She palled around with Tehran in that month. She, you know, had telephone chats with Hamas. It's shocking. And, you know, she did it all with a preening armor of self-righteousness. So I certainly don't think
Ronald
Lamola has that sort of pompous, preening self-righteousness at all. I mean, I met him several times during these negotiations you mentioned in June and July for the GNU, and he seemed quite a straightforward sort of chap. But, you know, your atmospherics and your attitudes are one thing. It's your achievements that you get judged by. So it is. It's too early to tell. I think the ANC also missed a beat by insisting. And they've got a very big foreign affairs ministry. It's got one minister and two deputy ministers. They refuse to have any opposition presence there. So it's a kind of walled off, it's a sealed mandate, if you like, for the ANC prejudices. And I think that's probably a mistake.
Was this made clear that there were no... that Foreign Relations DIRCO was ANC territory, no GNU partners in there at all?
It was sort of, that came in the second half of the negotiations. We put it up as one of the ministries we'd be interested in. And I remember Helen Ziller, same party, saying in our negotiations caucus before we go to meet the ANC, she'd just tell the ANC it's a non-negotiable. We're going to have Tony as our foreign minister in the GNU. Then you'll get them to make concessions on a range of other things. And that was a joke, but there's also some, you know, basic underlying truth in it because, you know, the ANC very much doesn't want, you know, outside handprints on it, what it sees as foreign design. Well, okay, that's their view, and they are the biggest party, not a majority party, incidentally. But then they've got to live with the consequences of that. And they have created this foreign policy regime of theirs. And I would say it's about to be stress tested in an extreme way. And let's see how it all plays out. But yes, they didn't want anyone from the opposition inside DIRCO. That was the bottom line. And as far as I know, they haven't allowed the opposition to even name a diplomat abroad, as far as I understand it. I don't know.
Yeah. So just now that we're talking about about South Africa and domestic issues, you played a big role in the formation of the Government of National Unity, and I was just wondering what you think of it. Are you happy with the results? Do you like what you see? Are you worried by what looks to be sort of constant bickering about almost everything? Are you anxious about it?
So I can answer yes to all of the above list that you've compiled. I have a lot of different views, and sometimes I think it's a really good thing. Not that it was necessarily the most elegant construction, but at least proves to the world and to ourselves, maybe more importantly, that on some core objectives we can work together. So I think that's a good thing, and I think you're seeing some progress. It might be very slow and of the incremental sort of what an engaged minister, you know, who gets to work on time, doesn't steal the money, and has an economically sensible outlook, an administrative competent one, can achieve. And I think we've seen some achievements. They early, but they there. And, you know, so I'm pleased about that. And look, the reason that and we've spoken about this before, Peter, and I've written about and so have you extensively. The reason this GNU was constructed wasn't because it was a fantastic deal for participating parties other than the ANC, which got the most out of it. It was because of the alternative that was on offer. Now, that alternative is still out there. It hasn't disappeared, you know, into the hills of Nkandla. I mean, the MK, EFF are waiting in the wings. So if, you know, if the bickering intensifies, if the non-negotiables start ramping up, then there is a possibility that this currently constructed GNU could come to an end. And I think that would be really bad news for the country. And I'm not speaking as someone, obviously, who was on the DA negotiating team. I'm just speaking as a citizen, as you are. It's in the non-partisan interests of South Africa that this GNU goes on and that it starts to make some significant achievements. I can't answer on how long it's for this world. Well, how little. I don't know that. Yeah. I hope that the cool heads prevail at the top. I don't know.
Yeah. So you're a former party leader and a very successful one in your time. Are the NHI, National Health Insurance, and the Better Bill, the Basic Education Laws Amendment Act, are they really red lines? I mean, in their current form, you know. And first of all, and are they red lines? Two, is one more important than the other? Walking away because you can't make the changes you want to, we know would be hugely consequential.
Yeah, look, let's deal with them separately and then together. I mean, the NHI is an absolute disaster, and in its current form, and if it leads to the destruction of medical aids, and if it leads to the abolition of private healthcare, which has been legislative intention, then not only would it be, you know, be disastrous for our country and for, you know, the middle class in this country, and probably for everyone else, because the entire healthcare system would topple over, then the DA would absolutely be quite correct to not just oppose it, but to say, well, this goes ahead from the government, where we can't sustain a government that supports this. Now, it's a bit more awkward because, in a way, Cyril the Great flourish, though it cost him a lot of votes, I was interested to see, signed that legislation before the election. So, in a way, you could say, well, this predates the GNU, but its implementation and rollout post-dates the GNU. So I don't think that any set of circumstances I can see that the DA can be party to that. And now, you know, the one way of doing it is a sort of split the difference approach. So, well, we'll carry on the government and we'll oppose it vigorously in the courts. I don't think most DA supporters would understand that. And that's the problem with the Bella Bill, incidentally. It's not actually that there aren't a raft of civil society movements, AfriForum, Solidarity, and a range of school organizations, school management committees, and so on, who can litigate against the act, which it now is. It's that the DA, a big chunk of the DA's constituency, the Afrikaans-speaking component of the DA vote, see this as the heralding the destruction of Afrikaans as a medium of instruction, which, you know, I don't know enough about the bill to tell you it's going to do that. I do know enough about sentiment to know that it's something that resonates very deeply. I mean, I was involved in the 1996 negotiations for the finalization of this constitution.
and the right to mother tongue education, which incidentally the Bella Act completely violates, in my view, but I'm not a constitutional lawyer engaged for this purpose, was, you know, huge issue in 1996. Well, it hasn't gone away in 2024. So, you know, they've kicked the can down the road. Someone informally advised me it's going to be kicked further down the road rather than decision. But at some point, there's going to be a decision on those two clauses of Bella Act. And we're going to have to see what the DA does. Does it note and protest? Does it note, protest, and depart? I really don't know, and I don't know the dynamics that are going to inform that decision, but it'll be a very difficult decision, I think.
The clear danger to the DA, a clear danger to the DA, whether or not the NHI and Bella Bills come to fruition in its time in the GNU, is that while Cyril Ramaphosa is an extremely good, I think he's a very good strategist, I mean, that's how he survived. I think he's a very poor leader. And that could mean that we get, in terms of getting things done, we could get to the end of his term, or end of this term, approaching 29, with unemployment largely unchanged, if not higher, the economy largely the same, if not weaker. And I wonder then whether the DA, at the end of all of this, and it's all very well to look active and get to work on time, as you say, to what extent is it going to be looking at 2029 and saying, my God, are we going to get blamed for this? Because the ANC is not going to get blamed for it. The DA will get blamed for it. The DA is the new element in government here. It's the reason things aren't happening. That's how the argument will go. In many ways, it's never ever going to get the credit. Whatever it does, good.
That always happens to junior partners in coalition governments, and the DA is not going to be an exception to that rule. But on the other hand, you know, as to quote the late President Kennedy, you know, a victory has 100 fathers, defeats as an orphan. If it actually manages, yep. but if there is, contrary to the rather negative picture you paint, because we don't know what's going to be like in 5 years' time, but if in 5 years' time the economy is rebounding, and unemployment has been dented, then, of course, the DA can do a bit of a little victory lap and say, well, we helped make it happen, which is a good election calling card. But look, the DA it's not a trade secret, this, Peter. The DA has been very explicit that the two reasons that it went into government, apart from preventing the EFF MK, which is a negative one, the positive one, was to improve the economy and help dent unemployment. So if that doesn't happen, if those two metrics are in the red zone or further red, then the DA would have failed in its participation in the GM. It will be actually a failure. And it knows that because it said that. I'm not saying it for them. So I think it's got its work cut out for it. And as you say, it's only got limited influence to help change that. And it's not so easy.
The
other problem, I think, in the whole GNU construction, as we often do, we talk about Trump as the personality, and you said correctly, Ramaphosa is a very shrewd strategist. This GNU was really created around and by him. But he's going to be a back number in, 2027? So in 3 years' time, actually not 5 years' time, Ramaphosa is going to be the deadest of lame ducks, or whatever, lamest of lame ducks, not dead, but lame. You know, you'll be a crippled duck, or whatever ducks do when they can't swim. So there'll be some other chap or woman who's going to be in charge of the ANC and directing the traffic and the coalition future, if there's one. And the DA is going to have much less influence there, as I see things, because in a way this was constructed or co-constructed with Ramaphosa at the helm. Now, you know, unless his successor is an arch Ramaphosaite, then I think there's going to be some interesting dynamics in 2027 ahead of the 2029 election.
Of course, Cyril will try his level best to get his candidate into the presidency of the ANC in 2027. And also, there's nothing stopping him from standing again, of course, you know.
Didn't work out very well for Tarbo.
Obviously, the ANC, No, it didn't work out very well for Thabo. So Cyril would be smarter than Thabo and look for a successor who will carry on with his so-called reform agenda and not toss the country into the sea along with the EFF and MK. Speaking of that, you know, the change in leadership in the ANC, I wanted to ask you one final question about the DA itself. You know, do you think, this is not to put you in a difficult position, though I know that it does, the party surely needs new leadership. Whatever it might be now in government, in the GNU, and there might be DA ministers suddenly, but it did very poorly, I thought, in the election. It barely managed to increase its vote by one percentage point, well short of what I think it should have been doing. And it can't surely go into 2029 thinking that that's a good place to be, you know, because it's 20% is just simply, you're not there. You can't keep the country safe at 20% without making all sorts of compromise. How does the possibility, if you wanted to be leader of the DA, I'm not talking about myself now, but how do leaders emerge in the DA? Because it's obviously a very centralized party. It seems to be, you know, it seems very centralized, very controlling. I mean, it may just be Helen, but that's the way it seems. It doesn't encourage MPs to stand up and say what they think or what they feel. You know, if something's going to be said, the leader has to say it. Or, you know, you stick to your lane in the DA. If you're the power shadow minister, you can talk about power or trade or whatever it might be. How do you develop a personality in the DA without getting yourself into trouble? Because it seems to me that that 2029, that election, this party's got to go into with very different attitudes and faces and at the top.
Yeah, well, look, I probably should take the Fifth Amendment on all these questions that you're asking, because, you know, I don't try and dictate or direct things from the political, well, not quite the grave, but certainly outside of the daily management of the party, where I happily sit far outside that, and I come back for high days and holy days. But, you know, the DA has got to interrogate matters very carefully. I said to them before the election that, you know, you're going to be at a crossroads, because unless there's a radical improvement in the DA performance, you know, the party is standing still. And it did stand still in this election, as you said, but it was saved by the fact that while it stood still, the ANC had a massive decline, and even the DA's, you know, modest improvement, very modest, got it some valuable political real estate. So, I don't think the party can be static or complacent. I think they've got to look at everything from the issue of leadership to the issue of strategy to the issue of its projection to the country and the world. And that's not a static process, dynamic one. I don't know, you know, how central, I guess leadership is fairly centralized these days. My day, it was also, I don't want to, you know, be too clever here. My day also, they always complain, my late great colleague Dean Smuts used to talk about the great sucking sound in the west wing of the parliamentary Marx building, which is my office. But I have to say, it was a sort of party where someone like Dean Smuts could stand up and say, as she always did, although we're very close friends, exactly what she thought about me, and very often wasn't very complimentary. I haven't been to a DA caucus meeting since 2009. I have no knowledge whether that pertains or not, and I've no knowledge as to what the quality of the internal debate is. But I do know two things. You've got to have a high-quality internal debate, and you've got to have people of courage who are prepared to advance what are unpopular causes, because otherwise the party is going to atrophy, and over time it will wither on the vine, and it won't actually be fit for purpose. That's what I can say. As to the dynamics and the personalities, probably best I say less.
Tony, it's such a pleasure always to talk to you. And thank you for joining me and for your wisdom and insight. And I want you just to tell me, I hear that you've written a new book and that it's going to be coming out. First of all, am I in it? I always check with your books to see if I'm in the index. Just a little reference here and there. What are you writing about, and what's it going to be called? When can we expect it?
The book is 9/10 done. I've just got to the last part now. It's called Being There, borrowed title, but since I was there at critical moments, is called, and the subtitle is Stories from Politics and the Wider World.
So it really is a collection of different thoughts.
I mean, it's all original. I haven't sort of repurposed my columns or anything. But I've just looked at what you might call some key moments, including there's quite a bit about the negotiations I was involved in with the GNU. And I, for once in my life, I mean, I never did it during CODESA. I did it during, you know, every time I had a tea and a chit-chat with Mandela. This time I kept a detailed diary. I wrote everything down. And when I didn't write everything down, I had a WhatsApp. So I had everything on WhatsApp. So that'll make for very interesting reading, I hope, or maybe not. Maybe very boring. Maybe it'll be redundant by then. There'll be no, but anyway. So
will it reveal things we don't already know?
I think it will. But you know, Peter, you'll have to read it and then interrogate me on it on this very impressive podcast and write about it.
No, absolutely.
And there were some columns in the Sunday Times.
So publication date is when?
April, May 2025.
Tony, thank you very much for joining me. Really appreciate it. Seeing as we started out talking about Trump and in the language of the Trumpets, I'm not going to wish you a happy holiday. I'm going to wish you happy Christmas. Apparently, we've all got to go back to, you know, let's speak the truth here.
Happy Christmas. But you can absolutely kosher in the Trump White House, definitely not in the Union buildings. You can say happy Christmas and happy Hanukkah. So I say both.
Okay, happy Hanukkah, and listeners, thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back soon. In the meantime, be safe. Bye-bye.